On October 3rd, 2016, at precisely 2 p.m., media organizations around the world began publishing stories drawn from the confidential archives of a Panamanian law firm. The firm was one of the largest providers of offshore shell companies, a key player in a secret economy that fuels trillions of dollars in tax evasion and criminal activity. The trove of documents, now known as the Panama Papers, included evidence touching on everything from arms trafficking to oil and gas exploration to international soccer. Government inquiries and prosecutions were launched in more than a dozen countries. Heads of state linked to the data were put on the defense. The Prime Minister of Iceland resigned. Now in the new book Secrecy World, Inside the Panama Papers, Investigation of Illicit Money Networks and the Global Elite, Jake Bernstein lays bare the complicated machinations of this shadow economy. Bernstein was a member of the international team of reporters who broke the story and has continued to report on the documents of the Panama Papers, exposing how shell companies operate, how the ultra-wealthy use them to evade taxes, and how they provide cover for illicit activities on a massive scale. It's a great pleasure to welcome Jake Bernstein to the roundtable this morning. Jake, thank you very much for being with us.
No, thank you for having me.
What brought you to the subject?
It all started with a phone call from a friend of mine who was a senior editor at the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. And he said, "We're working on something that's very interesting. We think you'd be perfect for it. And I can't tell you anything about it on the phone. So you have to come to Washington, D.C. and meet with the director of ICIJ, Jared Ryle, and the deputy director, Marina Walker." And so I did. And they told me that they had begun to receive data that had been leaked from a Panamanian law firm called Mossack Fonseca. And the data was already revealing very interesting things, like secret company held by the Prime Minister of Iceland and companies that seemed to connect directly to Vladimir Putin and other things. And as soon as they told me about it, I signed on. And then for the next year, I worked with more than 100 investigative reporters from all over the world on this extraordinary project called the Panama Papers. And after it published, I was still fascinated in the topic. There were parts of the story that I didn't think had been fully told, like, for example, the perspective of the two principals behind the law firm, Ramon Fonseca and Jürgen Mossack, as well as a deeper look into how this affects Americans and America's role in this offshore system, this secrecy world. And so I set out to do a book, and here we are.
One of the aspects of this that I find so fascinating is just what you described, that there is some 100 reporters working on this. It's an international team. They're from all over the world. How did you divvy it up and decide who was going to do what?
It actually ends up, at the end of the day, being about 340 reporters, if you include, you know, people who do web stuff and producers and all of that. But it was sort of 100 that did the hardcore work. And the magic of ICIJ, what they do, this International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, is they create the tools for these amazing collaborations. So they actually took what ended up being more than 11.5 million documents, like 2.6 terabytes of information, and made it all searchable, which in and itself was an extraordinary feat. And then they created a database that we could all log into, you know, through multiple layers of security. And then they also created a sort of parallel structure, which was like a Facebook for investigative journalists. They called it the Global iHub. And it was a place where we could, again, secretly meet and begin to share the information we were finding in the data. So, for example, I might find companies related to the King of Saudi Arabia, and I would put up information in a little subsection of the Global iHub about the Middle East, what I had found about the King of Saudi Arabia. And then an Egyptian reporter would add some stuff that he found. And then we would gradually sort of fill in the picture from different places all over the world. And if I needed court documents from Colombia to flesh out a story, the Colombian reporter would help me, and I would do the same for court documents in New York. And slowly we began to sort of figure out what the major stories were and the information that was contained within the database.
The information that is contained in the papers and the information that led to stories was so wide-ranging. I mean, that's the one of the things that's so incredible about this. Arms trafficking, oil and gas exploration, even international soccer. There is a lot here. Before we get into some of the individual stories, let's just talk about the Panamanian law firm itself. Give us the baseline of what we should know about that firm, how long they had been active, and ultimately what led to this this wide-ranging activity.
Sure. Well, the Ramon Fonseca and Jürgen Mosak joined forces in the mid-'80s. And you have to realize that it was a specific time for the secrecy world. Back then, if you wanted to create an anonymous shell company in Panama, for example, it was really quite easy. You sold the company. You didn't really ask too many questions about who might be the actual owner of this company. And you stuck the company in a file folder and forgot about it for a year until it was time to invoice for the renewal of the company. And so these two gentlemen had this sort of audacious idea of kind of becoming the McDonald's of the offshore system. You know, it would be high volume, low cost, right? They would just sell lots and lots of these companies to whoever wanted them. And it wasn't just Panama, it was the British Virgin Islands. I mean, they end up working with 21 different tax havens, including Nevada and Wyoming in the United States. But so they begin to do this, and they pump out more than 210,000 different companies and offshore entities. But gradually, there's an increase in vetting requirements from different tax havens and from different countries, right? I mean, governments begin to recognize that this is sort of out of control and is being used by money launderers and all this other stuff. And so they slowly begin to ask for more due diligence. Well, at that point, Mossack Fonseca has already released all of these companies into the wild, or many of them, and they can't really keep up. And it certainly conflicts with this model of high volume, low cost. And so I actually asked Jürgen Mosak if he had ever seen that wonderful I Love Lucy episode where Lucy is in the chocolate factory trying to keep up with the conveyor belt and it's going faster and faster. And in fact, he had, and he said it was somewhat similar to that. But so these guys are selling these companies pretty much to anybody who wants them, primarily to lawyers and bankers and accountants who are then giving them to their clients. And what we find through the Panama Papers is that, you know, there's more than 140 politicians from more than 50 countries that end up owning these companies, as well as you say, drug traffickers and money launderers and then just lots and lots of people who are using this system for tax avoidance and tax evasion. I mean, since the Panama Papers has been published, tax authorities worldwide have collected more than $500 million in taxes that were evaded through Mossack Fonseca and this system.
Jake Bernstein is our guest. The name of the new book, Secrecy World, Inside the Panama Papers Investigation of Illicit Money Networks and the Global Elite. Were they really good at what they do and what they did? Or does the answer have to be no, because ultimately they were caught?
Well, they were caught because of this leak, right? I mean, that's a function of it. They're one of the top five biggest players in this system at the time. I think it was a combination, right? I mean, they did grow too quickly, perhaps, and they were, you know, they were bad at internet security, clearly, because their data leaked out. So I think that the answer is probably yes and no. I mean, they were very good at what they did, and in some ways, they were very bad at what they did. You know, there have been other leaks from other offshore providers. After the Panama Papers, there was another leak called the Paradise Papers. This was of a firm called Appleby, which is based in Bermuda. And Appleby was not as big, a little bit more high-end, and a lot more corporate work. You know, there hasn't been illegalities, really, that have come out of that leak, although it's the same kind of tax avoidance and structures and things like that. You know, Mossack Fonseca was really trying in a way to lower the bar for access to this system. So they were growing at a time when there was burgeoning wealth in the developing world, and when sort of the communications in the world through the internet and that kind of stuff was allowing this system to really grow, and they took advantage of that, and ultimately it was like Icarus. They just went too close to the sun.
If I'm a client, why do I go to them? What am I hoping to achieve?
Well, I mean, there's two answers to that question, right? One is why do you use the system in general, and the other is why would you go to Mossack Fonseca? And one of the reasons you might go to Mossack Fonseca, or have your lawyer go to Mossack Fonseca, particularly in the early days, is that there would be very little due diligence. You know, they wouldn't vet you. They wouldn't ask too many questions. And even if they did ask questions, you know, you could kind of put them off. You know, you could say, oh, yeah, we'll get to that. They were more interested in selling these companies than really finding out what they were being used for. And in fact, they claim that they had no responsibility to do so, which is arguable at best. Now, as far as using this offshore system, I mean, there's lots of, we must say that there's nothing necessarily illegal with having an anonymous shell company. And there are, you know, reasons why you might do that. That would be completely legitimate, in some cases legal, but morally questionable. So, for example, if you wanted to legally avoid taxes, or if you were operating in multiple countries and you wanted to base your operations in a low tax place because it just made more sense, or if you're worried about liability, or if you're working in a business and you want to do a side business but you don't want your business partners to know, or say you have a mistress and you want to buy her an apartment and you don't want anyone to know that. So these are all sort of reasons why you might do it, and they would sort of technically be legal. But through this same system, this legal system is flowing, you know, trillions of dollars of illegal money, money laundering and criminals and corrupt politicians and tax evasion, rampant tax evasion. And so, you know, because of the lack of transparency, because this is a secrecy world, you can't sort of weed out the good from the bad.
The name of the book is Secrecy World, Inside the Panama Papers Investigation of Illicit Money Networks and the Global Elite. Just the title, Secrecy World, you just mentioned it a moment ago. So you do have to wonder, is anything secret then?
Yes. Lots and lots is still secret. I mean, really, what this leak allowed us to see is sort of a macro view of this world, as well as, you know, lots of individual cases in a way that had never really been possible before, at least to this extent. But it's still going on. I mean, as I said, Mossack Fonseca was only one of the top four or five firms that offer this business. It's still being used. And the fact that you know, the tax collectors have now collected so much money just off this one leak indicates that this is sort of widespread. I mean, the United States government estimates that something like $300 billion a year is laundered through the United States alone. So, I mean, that's clearly sort of an indication that the secrecy world is thriving. I mean, the UN thinks that it could be as much as $2 trillion worldwide. So, yeah. It's still secret, and what I show in my book Secrecy World, and what you can really see through the Panama Papers, is that this is almost like an organic, you know, organism. It sort of evolves and moves around to continue its activities and to maintain its existence. And so, for example, if a tax haven in the British Virgin Islands or in Jersey sort of tightens up their requirements and they need more, they ask for more information, you could see the system sort of move to other places like Dubai or Singapore that continue to be very opaque.
Where are the main players in this now from that firm? Where are they, and what ramifications did they face?
Well, it's a very good question. So they are keeping a very low profile. Ramon Fonseca and Jürgen Mossack are both in Panama. They were arrested this year and imprisoned for a little more than 2 months. This is sort of a preventive imprisonment that you can do in Panama because they were deemed a flight risk. And then they were released. And there are several prosecutions that are sort of underway. remains to be seen what happened, what will happen with them. Their law firm was pretty much destroyed by this. At one point, they had 600 employees. I think they're down to about 80 now. This is not a kind of business where you can just turn out the light, right? I mean, you've got all these companies out there. There's still governments that are asking for information about them. You've got to sort of have a wind down. So they're doing that. But Jürgen Mosek said something quite interesting, which was that he thinks the biggest beneficiary of this leak, the true winner in some ways, was the United States and to a lesser extent, the UK. And that's because the United States and the United Kingdom are really the biggest players in this secrecy world. They're the ones that set the rules, and they are, you know, allowing for it to flourish. So, for example, you know, Delaware creates hundreds of thousands of anonymous shell companies, and governments around the world have complained about this. The U.S. government has complained about this and said that Delaware companies are being used by the Russian mafia and transnational gangs and other criminals. And yet it seems like the U.S. government can do nothing about this. And Delaware pulls in about $1 billion a year from its public registry. So it's making good money from this. It has no interest not only in stopping this or cleaning it up or adding more transparency, but they have fought tooth and nail in the halls of Congress to keep it going.
So given that, and also given the release of the Panama Papers and this investigation, doesn't that hurt it? I mean, there are outside forces that look at this and say, okay, we understand, and I think people who are listening to you certainly understand why these groups would want to change it, and they don't want that money to go away. But overseers are looking at it and saying, oh, okay, well, that's not right. Let's change it. So does it have an overall effect on the system?
I mean, it really sometimes feels like that the two steps forward or one step forward, two steps back kind of thing. When I began this book project shortly after the publication of the initial publication of the Panama Papers in April 2016, I thought that this was a very positive story in some ways, that you know, that there had been a gradual move towards more transparency and a tightening up of restrictions about this world, and that the leak investigations by journalists had cast light on it and sort of forced some positive change. And that, in fact, is true to some extent. And then Donald Trump was elected. So, I mean, Trump and the people around him are able and apt and practiced users of this secrecy world. Trump himself said on the campaign trail that he had 515 companies with 378 of them registered in Delaware. And their tax bill that was just passed by the Republican Congress, if anything, will favor this system and will encourage this kind of corporate tax avoidance and also individual tax avoidance through real estate. And so, yes, I actually think that that in some respects it's getting better, and it really depends on the country that you look at. But certainly in the United States, it's not. There's these things called bearer shares. They're extraordinary. Bearer shares are actual certificates. They're pieces of paper. And whoever physically holds the piece of paper owns the company. And this is something that governments have hated for a long time because they're sort of tailor-made for money laundering. So, for example, if I have an anonymous shell company owned by bearer shares, and that company has a bank account or a piece of property or something like that, and I hand you the certificate, the piece of paper, the bearer share for this company, then you own the bank account. You own the piece of property. And so it's impossible to track. And governments have been, you know, campaigning to try to outlaw them or restrict them. And over time, you have seen countries do that. So they either forbid them altogether or they require that they be put under custodianship. So, for example, you have to have the certificate in a lawyer's safe or a banker's safe, and then that lawyer and banker needs to know who actually owns the certificate, right? There's only two jurisdictions in the world now that offer bearer shares. They are the Marshall Islands and Liberia. Well, what's interesting about the Marshall Islands and Liberia? The public registries for both of those countries are not, in fact, in the Marshall Islands or Liberia. They are in New York and Virginia. So it is the United States that is allowing this. It is the United States that that has continued to permit this system to flourish, both for corporations and for individuals. And so, you know, until that changes, I don't think there will ultimately be real transparency and a real effort to clean up the abuses that the system creates.
With the release of these documents, the Prime Minister of Iceland was forced to resign. What happened in that case that didn't happen elsewhere?
Well, it did happen in a couple of other places. I mean, the president of Pakistan was also forced to resign. But, I mean, I think that the key there, and it's a very interesting question, because the key there was the Icelandic people. You know, they were fed up. They had gone through an economic cataclysm in the financial crisis, and they were just not going to tolerate their leaders lying to them and participating in this kind of behavior. And they took to the streets. They surrounded the parliament building and pelted it with yogurt and eggs, and they had a huge rally. And eventually it became untenable, and the prime minister had to resign. In Pakistan, it was the Supreme Court that forced the ouster of the president after the Panama Papers revealed that his family had several companies that owned property in London that he couldn't really explain. So it's ultimately people power that makes the change. You know, that's why Europe in some ways is further along than the United States in this respect. After the financial crisis, there was real austerity in Europe. And Europeans were forced to cut back quite rigorously, quite dramatically. And so when they saw that the citizens, the wealthiest citizens among them, were evading taxes and not paying their fair share, even while the majority was forced to tolerate severe cutbacks in social services, they took to the streets. They got very angry and they forced their politicians to act. And so those connections have not been made fully in the United States. And that's part of the reason why I wrote Secrecy World, is because people think that this is all happening in some, you know, far off place with tropical breezes and palm trees. And the reality is it's happening here in the United States. Part of the reason why, you know, property prices in New York and in Los Angeles and in San Antonio and in Miami are so high is because foreigners are using anonymous shell companies to buy up property to park cash. And oftentimes that is the product of money laundering or corrupt officials. You know, part of the our government says that they don't have enough money for healthcare, for infrastructure, for education, for police. And the reality is part of the reason they don't have the money is because it is being parked offshore by individuals and by corporations who are not paying their fair share. And so this is something that actually relates to all of us and should matter to all of us.
The name of the book is Secrecy World, Inside the Panama Papers Investigation of Illicit Money Networks and the Global Elite. It is by Jake Bernstein. It is published by Holt. Jake, thank you very much for sharing with us this morning. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
No, thank you so much, Joe. Have a great day.
Thank you very much. You too. Again, the name of the book is Secrecy World, published by Holt. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.